Welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast. I'm Evan Schwartztraber. On today's show, how does the FDA regulate e-cigarettes, and how does that impact the businesses who have to navigate this web of complex regulations we talked about on the show before? So a brief history. In 2009, Congress passed the Tobacco Control Act, and that gave the FDA authority to regulate tobacco products. And at the time, e-cigarettes were not part of that. But in 2014, the FDA signaled that it was going to begin the process of developing rules for e-cigarettes. And in 2016, they dropped the hammer and basically said that, yes, e-cigarettes are tobacco products and we will be regulating them as such, even though e-cigarettes do not actually contain tobacco. They contain nicotine derived from tobacco. That's an important distinction. But the regulations set off essentially a two-year shot clock for manufacturers of e-liquid or other vapor products to get approval from the FDA. And while during that two-year period, they can operate business as usual for the most part, at a certain point, you have to undergo the onerous research and compliance efforts to get past these hurdles. Now, very few companies, as we talked about on the show, have the resources to actually do this. But my guests today are from one of the few companies that is going to try to get approval from the FDA. The FDA admitted itself that only about 1% of companies would even do this. So 99%, if nothing else changes, will be forced off the market. Now, Congress has taken a look at providing regulatory relief to some of these companies. Those efforts have thus far failed. So far, the FDA has given a three-month extension on that two-year deadline. So we're looking at November 2018 for people to file. And I'm going to interview two people who are doing this and get a real-world sense of how regulations that get passed impact people at a very granular level. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce Chris Howard, General Counsel and Chief Compliance Officer at eAlternative Solutions, and Jeff Sanderson, Senior Digital Manager at the same company, eAlternative Solutions. Gentlemen, thanks so much for joining.
Thank you. Yeah,
thanks for having us.
So you mentioned to me that the company was founded in 2015. So that was a time when you knew there were regulations coming out, but you didn't know exactly what they were. So what was your first reaction when you heard that the FDA was going to be developing rules?
It didn't come as a surprise to us. And just to be clear, Jeff and I joined eAlternative Solutions after 2015. Before this, we were both in the industry. We used to work for Blue. So we knew that FDA was going to deem e-vapor products pursuant to the Tobacco Act. But of course, at the earliest stages, we weren't sure how onerous these would be. What ultimately happened was we started seeing previews of the rule, which looked much like the final rule ended up becoming.
Yeah, August 8th, 2016.
Right. And so that the final version of that was published in May, and they said, look, it's going to be going to effect in August on August 8th of 2016. And that's exactly what happened. So as we ramped up to that time, we knew, certainly by May, we were aware that this was going to be a very cost prohibitive, expensive, and time consuming process.
Yeah, and we've heard all sorts of statistics thrown out. And part of the reason I wanted to have you on the show was to get a sense of what that actually looks like for a business, because I've had people come on and say, okay, it could cost anywhere between $300,000 and millions of dollars to get approval for a single product. And the reason for that is that the FDA essentially decided that any product that is not substantially similar to something on the market in 2007, they have to get approval. Now, the market for e-cigarettes in 2007 looks nothing like it does today. It was essentially a online community of people messing around with dangerous stuff. There was not a lot of standardization, not a lot of safety. And then it's evolved, and it's been an innovative industry. And now 10 years later, we see all sorts of flavors and different mods and people. You walk down the street and everyone's got a different looking e-cigarette. But because all those products were not on the market, they have to go through this process. So when people throw around these numbers like 300,000, millions of dollars, is that accurate? I mean, is that essentially what the pain that you are going through as a company right now?
Let's just be clear. I mean, that's just for the application process for getting your product authorized for marketing and sale in the United States. You know, that's the PMTA, which I believe you've talked about.
Pre-market tobacco approval.
You got it. And sure, there's some really high price tags with that, but the rule encompasses much more. I mean, there's many deadlines you have to meet along the way. Each of these carry their own costs. There's certain regulations which apply to the facilities where we manufacture these products. That's expensive. When you look at a total package, this is a hugely expensive rule that most companies cannot even comply with the simplest pieces, whether that's the ingredient disclosure, the product registration, the facility registration, making sure your plants are up to speed. It's not easy. For an individual PMTA, let me give you some perspective from a company who's going through the process. I think we know that the agency said that each PMTA would cost somewhere in the range of $300,000 to $500,000 per SKU. So I could say here fairly confidently that most vape shops that have thousands of SKUs are probably not going to be able to participate. And many of them have chosen not even to try. But for a company like us that has around 100 SKUs, We would guess that the price tag, if we did as much as we wanted to do, I'll tell you this, we know that the price tag could be as high as $50 million. And of course, we're trying to incorporate some efficiencies to bring that cost down, but $50 million for 100 SKUs is a very real number. For perspective, Altria recently published an article, there was some kind of an interview they did, which said that one SKU for their heat not burn product, a PMTA, would cost around $2.5 million or more. We may not be at $2.5 million per SKU, but I think if we broke it down in our case, we're over $500,000.
And a SKU, is that essentially any product variation? Because one of the criticisms of the rule was that it would force you to have less diversity in your inventory, that you'd have to make sure that the batteries are all kind of the same and that the flavors are the same. I mean, when we're talking about a SKU, could that be a flavor? Could that be the size of your product? What are the variations that require extra applications?
That's exactly what it is. In our case, the eAlternative Solutions primary product offering is the Q Vapor System. And the Q Vapor System consists of a device which has a battery in it that you then hook a cartridge to it. The cartridge contains a flavor, and you vaporize each closed system cartridge as you go. Well, for us, one SKU could be the device itself, which comes with one cartridge. And so that's like the kit. Or each individual flavor is a SKU, and each nicotine level of each flavor is a SKU.
So including the zero, right? Because I want to point out that there's some misinformation out there. Some e-cigarettes do not even contain nicotine. And I think that your company actually offers a zero nicotine cartridge, and then there's a 3 milligram and a 6 milligram. And the idea is that a smoker who comes in with a heavy addiction might start out high and then wean themselves off of the nicotine. And then you're looking at they're just vaping whatever else is in the product.
That's exactly right. We have for each flavor, we have a 0 milligram, a 3 milligram, and a 6 milligram. I think our initial offering in the kit comes with the 3 milligram, but of course the trend, many or most smokers buy the 6 milligram pack to start. You know, they want 6 milligram, and sure, some of them, despite the fact that we don't market our products for cessation or as a healthier alternative to cigarettes, I think the natural progression is they start with 6, and internally they have a desire to go from 3 to maybe 0 to no product at all. With respect to whether or not the FDA has authority to regulate 0 milligram liquids, they certainly believe they do. I think that there are different views with respect to whether that they're overreaching in that regard, particularly in a case of a closed system product where we do have a 0 milligram offering that cannot and is not intended to be used with any other nicotine-containing substance. So when we're looking at our analysis, sure, we include 100 SKUs just as a rough estimate for you to kind of convey the meaning and how much each of these things cost. But with regard to whether every company will file PMTAs for 0 milligram products, I can't say that definitively.
So let's do a little definition here of some of these terms that we're throwing around. So a closed system, that I'm looking at your product right now, it's on the table, and essentially it's got a unit and then disposable cartridges. And they call that a closed system because the customer is not actually handling the liquid themselves. They cannot open the cartridge to handle the liquid. You can't really tamper with the product, because that's been one of the concerns raised by critics of e-cigarettes. When we're dealing with an open system, you buy the liquid maybe in small bottles or in bulk, and you add that liquid into a system.
Yeah, you know, it's worth taking a moment to differentiate. I mean, when someone says e-cigarette, what do most people think of? Well, they think of the first generation e-cigarette, like an Enjoy product or a Blu, which is a cig-alike. It looks like a cigarette.
Yeah, and they're they look like little cigarettes, and they're small, and you throw them out when
you're done. And they're all closed. They're not intended for people to manipulate the liquid that's in there, but they're simple, and I would say overall, most people have not found them to be very satisfying. So what happens happened there in the industry. There was a progression towards these open systems, the mods, the tanks, and the things that you'll walk down the street and see people using these big devices, which those are very complicated to use. And they have a bigger battery, and people fill them with their choice of liquids. And they'll go to vape shops, and the vape shops always traditionally have mixed those liquids right in the store, and people can pick and choose. And the reason people gravitated toward those is because they do get a better satisfaction. I mean, they're with a bigger battery, they're able to create bigger vapor clouds, they're able to get a feeling closer to cigarette smoking. And so you could see why the industry naturally progressed a little bit more in that direction.
And it's also a cost thing, right? It's cheaper if for the customer if they're buying the liquid themselves and then adding it into the product.
Exactly. Yeah. It's certainly cheaper than cigarettes in many states with the high taxation and all right. that. And so you could see why people would choose that. But what happened there, so you have a, let's just talk about a traditional smoker and not a vapor. So if a traditional smoker started with an e-cig, a cig-alike, and they found they didn't like it. So someone then tells them, well, go try the open system. And they find they do like it. But now they got to carry around this big clunky thing and change coils and spill liquid on themselves. And many of these products are cheaply made and they leak. And so I think what people then say, well, forget it. I'm just going to go back to smoking. So now the evolution of the product, which by the way, evolution and innovation is temporarily stalled because of the new FDA rule.
Right.
But the Q vapor system, our product, is a closed system that uses a sub-ohm mechanism, which is much like an open system, but people can't fill it themselves.
So you're trying to basically get the best of both worlds.
You want
the convenience that a smoker is used to, which is I smoke and I throw it out and I'm done.
But
you don't want them to lose that extra satisfaction that they're finding with the open system. Now, one interesting thing I heard is that a closed system has a better chance of getting through FDA approval. Why is that?
I personally believe a closed system does because you've minimized any chance for direct contact with the liquid, I mean, which is something that FDA rightfully is concerned about. You've taken care of some of the child safety issues, which youth is a huge priority, not just for FDA, but also for us. And frankly, you're in better control of the entire device. In our case, we've got temperature control, a battery that only hits a maximum voltage, all the things that FDA would think would be valuable in terms of finding a product which they can authorize. If you compare it to, say, an open system where you can crank that the voltage up and the wattage up to 200, who knows? I mean, you could see you have a higher likelihood of creating some of the constituents which FDA deems to be a problem. And in a closed system like ours, it's not going to happen.
So one of the big sticking points for critics of e-cigarettes, and they're mostly in the Democratic Party, we've talked about that on previous episodes, that this doesn't seem like it's a partisan issue, but somehow it has become a partisan issue. But they're very concerned about marketing. And there's a lot of concern that e-cigarette companies, because they're dealing in flavors and they're dealing with these large clouds that people seem to enjoy, that it's a marketing thing, that they're marketing it as a lifestyle choice and that it will be attractive to children. What do you say to people who argue that companies are marketing to kids or they're trying to promote vaping as a lifestyle rather than just as a cessation tool?
Yeah, I mean, look, that marketing issue is a big one, and it's three things. I mean, number one is exactly what you said. Unfortunately, many vapor companies use cartoon characters and other things or names of flavors like bubblegum and things, which arguably could be attractive to youth. And I actually gave a presentation recently on behalf of the Vapor Technology Association, which talked about best practices for marketing. And even though it's not explicit in the rule, there are certainly steps that regular companies can take to minimize attractiveness of the products to youth. The other thing that people struggle with when it comes to marketing is look, everyone wants to go out and say that e-cigarettes are better for you than traditional cigarettes. And sure, maybe we all might believe that, you know, common sense would say that. But we're not allowed to do that. So we don't market our products as healthier. And frankly, there aren't long-term studies which show that the products, I mean, maybe we, again, think it's common sense, but there aren't long-term studies which say that they are tools which are to be used for smoking cessation, for quitting. So, but many companies don't, they disregard that and they say that anyway. And so that causes a disconnect and makes people, makes many uncomfortable, I guess, with marketing practices generally. So standardized marketing practices can help. And I think that's probably a very reasonable request from a government agency or from a politician or what have you. Take steps to minimize attractiveness to youth or to make sure that we don't make claims which haven't been proven yet, And I think many companies are trying to do that. The problem is no one's going to be able to participate at all because they're not going to be able to meet the hurdles we talked about earlier to get the products authorized in the first place.
And you could argue perversely that by prohibiting companies from marketing their device as a cessation tool, because, I mean, we know that the Royal College of Sciences, Public Health England say it's at least 95% less harmful than smoking. Common sense would tell you that it's less harmful than smoking because it's vaporizing and not combustion. And there's no tar. And we know that people die from the tar, but they get addicted to the nicotine. There's a famous quote from a medical guy about that. I forget who it was. But you could argue that because you don't allow companies to market it as a more of a medical thing, as a way to quit a harmful practice, all that's left for them to market on is the lifestyle stuff and is branding. So do you think that in the absence of that restriction, if e-cigarette companies were allowed to market the benefits for cessation, there would be less of a temptation for them to market it as like a cool, fun thing to try?
Probably. I mean, it's hard to generalize and speak for the industry. I mean, no question, most tobacco products in our history have used lifestyle as the primary mechanism to gain consumer interest. And as you probably know, tobacco companies did a lot of things they shouldn't have done years ago. And no one wants to see a repeat of that.
Yeah, Joe the Camel comes up in this debate a lot.
There you go.
You know, and
that's
they don't
right.
want to see vaping companies doing something
and they don't.
Like that.
So yeah. if we had more flexibility to talk about this common sense argument, much like the consensus reached in UK, as you mentioned.
Yeah.
Sure, I think it would probably lower the likelihood that they use improper means to market the products.
So I want to get back to the regulations because, you know, you guys have seen firsthand what it takes to go through this process. And is there anything in particular that stands out as either ridiculously expensive or unclear or hard to navigate? Because there's so many pages and there's so much that you have to go through. But in order for policymakers to figure out a better way to regulate, they need to hear from business owners to say, what is it that was particularly problematic in your application process?
It's really the quantity and time associated with the development of the data which FDA is requesting. So right now, and I will just speak at the highest level here because I don't want to bore the audience to death, but we have to do chemistry testing. We have to do toxicological testing. We have to do clinical trials. We have to do behavioral work. And by that, I mean you're collecting data regarding whether people like the product and whether it is attractive to youth. And we, all of these things, many of the studies that we're currently engaged in will take 12 months to complete. So even if we started these studies today, which, by the way, if you haven't started today, you're kind of too late. But if you start the study today, to do 12 months of data development and then write up the report and get your consultants involved to help you in terms of your analysis, even now, it's a close call to see if we could get it done by November. That's with the 3-month extension. If you haven't started today, I would say it's almost impossible to meet the deadlines. And if you don't meet the deadlines, that means you don't have the data, and now you're going to submit an incomplete application, which puts you at risk for not being authorized.
And critics of the deeming rule have said that it's almost designed to fail, that it's not a very welcoming application process. And if you look at it, it's almost like they're trying to get companies to trip up and screw up. Is that the sense you got from looking at it? Were you just like, wow, I mean, if you wanted to set out to destroy my business, this would be a great way of doing it?
You know, it's a tricky one. I certainly have heard the argument. I can't say that FDA would intentionally want to go out and destroy the market. But I think that they have ultimately put in a standard which is much too onerous. And so if you just think, for example, of a vape shop owner who has 100 SKUs or 1,000 more likely, there's no way they are equipped to spend the millions of dollars that's required to develop the data. So what do you think they do? I mean, they probably are just praying that there is some change that makes the rule go away. And yeah, their fingers are crossed that maybe they hope that Cole Bishop passed or what have you. And thus far, they haven't gotten a lot of breaks. And so whether FDA intentionally did it or not, the only people that are able to play in the space or that will be able to play in the space, if nothing changes, would be Big Tobacco. And by that, I'm talking about Reynolds and Altria, who have resources beyond our imagination to comply with the rule, and us, which we're also fortunately situated. We have a team in-house that we've hired, a compliance team that is equipped to work with FDA to make sure we get our products across the line. It's not cheap. We also have resources. We have money which we can devote to this, and we're very much committed to the process. I can't name too many other companies that are similarly situated. I mean, most will be driven off the market, whether that was the intent or not.
So no regulation at all is, of course, unrealistic. I mean, I'm sure there are some libertarians out there who'd love to just see a world where people could make whatever choices they make and live with the consequences, but that is just not going to happen. So when you look at this deeming rule, and of course there are things you'd like to get rid of, what does it get right? Is there anything that you're like, you know what, the FDA is appropriately addressing a concern, or at least they've identified concerns, things that regulators should be looking at? Maybe they've gone about it in the wrong way, but I kind of want to get a sense from the business community of what you see as acceptable, appropriate, smart regulation that protects consumers from actual harm.
No, that's a great question. And look, let me be clear. I totally do not think that having no regulation is the right answer. I mean, every market, you know, especially with a product like this, should be have some degree of regulation. So what does FDA get right? Implementing quality control type standards for manufacturing facilities, that's important, right? Nobody wants a product with harmful constituents in it or that gets contaminated. So doing things to make sure that the plants are equipped is important. Implementing certain product standards is important. You know, I don't want a product that has carcinogens in it. I mean, not to the level that's going to cause me harm and that sort of a thing. So I think having reasonable product standards makes sense. What the biggest problem here is, and this is very different than what was implemented in Europe, where in Europe, you know, you do also have to develop a lot of data. You submit it, you provide notice, and you keep selling. If there's a problem, you'd like to think that the government there would then seek you out and say, here's the problem, let's work to fix it. Here, there is no grace period aside from this 2-year window. If we have a problem, I should say, if we begin developing our data, we submit it all for review. If they don't like it, it's over. They take you off the market and you're done. And that's a problem. I mean, right now, most people won't even submit the data. So once you get to November 8th, I guess it is now, if they haven't submitted an application, they technically are not supposed to be for sale.
Jeff, I want to give you a chance to jump in. You've been very patient and respectful of Chris and I back and forth. But so, you know, Chris is, of course, the general counsel, and he's dealing with so much legalese and trying to navigate this complicated process. You, as the digital manager at eAlternative Solutions, I mean, how do the regulations impact your day-to-day?
Oh, great question. There's really crazy things that we have to do to comply online, right? And we're currently doing it, and it ties in with the testing and things that Chris is doing as well. So one thing that comes to mind really quickly is that we are required to have 20% of the screen on the website with a warning, okay? So when you come to our website, imagine 20% of the screen says, warning, this product contains nicotine.
Is right. there any other industry that has to do anything like that?
Traditional cigarettes. I mean, they have right. some rules, not to the extent of these rules, but sure. I mean, and that's what we try to pattern our practices. And Jeff will frequently compare to what the cigarette companies have done too.
So then how else does your digital life get shaped by the rules?
Well, to that point though, if you really look, right, the tobacco companies don't sell online, right? That's a big difference, right? Cigarette companies don't sell online. They might have a website and it's a loyalty program, or you get coupons or whatever, right? But we sell online, and we've, you know.
That's how the industry began.
Exactly, right? And so we, you know, don't really have a thought that we're not going to sell online, right? So we want to comply with what we need to do. And so that's one of them. A few other rules is... So there is city and state bans as well, right? And so this has been a fairly big burden because we have to write certain scripting and rules to where if you, for example, Massachusetts, right? Massachusetts, you can't sell flavors in Massachusetts, right? So when somebody comes onto our website, they can still purchase the Q starter kit, and I'm using Q as an example, and they can also purchase a menthol, or they could also purchase a full tobacco product, right? But they can't purchase a flavor, so you have to write that scripting. And that's an easy one because it's on a state level. Well, I shouldn't say that because there is some counties in Massachusetts, but we've taken the position that all of Massachusetts falls under this, right? But there's also the same thing on a city level. And so I believe that Chicago is one of those, or Cook County. And you know, that's much tougher to actually write the script because there's so many zip codes, right?
So you need to make sure that the website experience for someone living in a state or a city complies with those local and state regulations on top of you're already dealing with the federal regulations. And that's something we've talked about in tech policy in general. It's that, you know, I'm all about federalism and states' rights and local control to an extent. But when you're dealing with interstate commerce and e-commerce and things that are, you know, national and international in nature, that is a serious burden, and it trickles down even to the how you build your website.
Right. Well, so one last point to the website build. We also are required, if you are 26 or under, right, and this is the interpretation that we are taking and the position we're taking, if you're 26 or under, you are required to submit a photo ID, right? Now, typically that would be in a store, right? You go into the store, you're under 27. We have all seen the signs, right? If you're under 27, have your ID ready, something like that, right?
Yeah.
But that's also online, right? Because we're selling our product online. And so I've just got done actually building this special program. It's an age verification software, right? You go through and you place your order online and you're 25 years old, okay? We've created this special program to where when you become age verified, you failed, right? And you must submit a photo ID to us, right? So that's another huge burden that we've taken on. There's no real companies that are already doing this, right? So you can't go, I mean, there is one or two, but you can't just go and buy the software, right? You have to create it special. And it's been a pretty big burden as well.
So these regulations come out and businesses have to make decisions about, you know, you mentioned some that are just hope and pray, right? You see Congress might do something, or if Scott Gottlieb becomes the next FDA chairman, he might do something that that helps alleviate the regulatory burden. But what would you have done differently? Because I have a hard time believing that businesses operate exactly the same way with or without the deeming rule.
I'll tell you, and it's funny because we haven't really chatted about probably the biggest impact. I mean, of course, spending millions of dollars is significant, but the biggest impact is how it has cut short innovation. I mean, completely. And what we would have done differently is we'd be working. I mean, the industry has been very fast-paced in terms of technological developments. And even the Q is a product of an evolution, right? You go to Sigalike to open systems and now a closed system sub-ohm device. But innovation has stopped. I mean, that two-year window we talked about, this period of time we have between now and November of 2018, we're not allowed to launch anything new. All we can do is work on the product that we have and develop the data associated with that product. What would we be doing differently? We would and did have a whole innovation platform, and we'd be talking about new products. But to launch a product now, and by now I mean after August 8th of 2016, if we wanted to launch the Q2, we can't. We'd have to do all the same data development that I just told you about. In other words, spend all these millions of dollars and then submit the application and wait. And we have to wait for FDA to authorize us, which could take years. I mean, if the history in tobacco is of traditional cigarettes is any indicator, I mean, there's a backlog of several thousand substantial equivalence applications that FDA hasn't gotten to. There's only been one PMTA ever granted for eight snus products, and that was very, very recent. So for us, I mean, and I think probably for many vapor companies that are similarly situated, it has immediately stopped innovation. We are not at this time devoting resources, which we otherwise would have been devoting, to helping make a better product that smokers would enjoy.
And even if Cole Bishop were to pass, that wouldn't actually fix that problem, because it would just move the date from 2007 to 2016, which would preserve the current market and allow and would alleviate some of the burden on the application process. But still, you'd have that date at August 2016, so you would not allow for innovation. So unless there's more administrative action at the FDA level, or if Congress were to pass a new bill on how to regulate e-cigarettes, that is the problem. And that's why my organization is so interested in this, because people have wondered, like, what is Tech Freedom doing about e-cigarettes? Like, it's not a tech policy issue, but it's innovation. We're talking about an industry that has come in that's disrupted the way people consume nicotine. It's disrupted healthcare. We're talking about 500,000 people dying every year from smoking-related illnesses. That's innovation. So what the FDA did was essentially hit the pause button on an entire industry. And you don't see many examples of this. You can look at other industries and say, this was burdensome, this could have been easier, whatever. This was a whole scale pause button on an entire industry. And now we're going to see less innovation until something changes. Now we've covered a lot of ground here. Is there anything you'd like to leave the listeners with before we close the show?
Yeah, I mean, myself personally, I think, and we talked just a little bit about what the UK has done and how that has been a very positive development. You know, innovation hasn't stopped globally. I mean, there's right. still activity ongoing in Europe, and that's because the UK government, like the Royal College of Physicians and other key stakeholders, have gotten together and they've agreed on certain, they've reached consensus on certain overall messaging, and they work around that consensus. In other words, we don't want to stop this from happening. And that really hasn't happened here. There hasn't been consensus. So for every one of you or me that says this regulation is unfair, you have others saying, well, we think it's reasonable. Every time someone wants to support Cole Bishop, you've got another group of people. We don't want to move the predicate date because it'll leave a market with an unregulated market. And any step which the government and interested stakeholder companies like us or politicians or medical facilities or the Surgeon General, any step where we can just reach some basic consensus would be very meaningful. And I do believe that we're slowly moving in that direction. And hopefully this 3-month extension of time, which the FDA recently granted, hopefully that is a suggestion that people are reevaluating the current state, because that's really what has to happen here. We have to reevaluate the current state.
Statistically speaking, some of my listeners must be smokers themselves. If they are interested in quitting and potentially using your product, where can they go to find out more?
Well, and just a reminder that we don't, and we're prohibited from marketing our products as cessation tools.
Yeah. But amazing how that comes up at the, even in this recording.
Sad, but true. Yeah. But if they want to learn more about the Q in particular, which is a great product and certainly the most innovative, I believe, that's out there today, they could go to QVapor.com. And that's the whole digital platform, which is managed by Jeff. And Jeff, there may be other outlets. I mean, we do run an infomercial. So like you mentioned before, most companies have taken a lifestyle approach. And let me be clear, we have some lifestyle components, but we have we've kind of gone to the next level. We also incorporate an educational platform. So we run an infomercial late at night, obviously, tailoring to meet demographics which don't touch on youth. But whether it's via the TV commercial, our website, qvapor.com, I know, Jeff, you've got some social media pages and that sort of a thing, which you could share. There's a lot of ways to get information about Q.
Yeah, sure. And you know, we're on, this is another, you know, kind of rare thing for the industry, right? It's on social media. And so you could find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all of them are at Q Vapor, right? But again, you don't see that in the tobacco space, right? And you do here. And so, you know, we'll see how that plays out as we go forward.
Right. And for Q, just to be clear, it's not the letter Q, it's C-U-E Vapor.
We'll put a link to the website the show notes for today, but we'll leave it there. My guests have been Chris Howard, General Counsel and Chief Compliance Officer at eAlternative Solutions, and Jeff Sanderson, Senior Digital Manager at eAlternative Solutions. Gentlemen, thanks for joining.
Thanks for having us.
And if you're wondering why I sound different, I'm a little under the weather. And if you're wondering what those crackling noises were, that was actually the cue in action. So you've gotten to hear the noise it makes, and maybe that'll interest you to look at the website. But that's all. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Tech Freedom. Let us know what you think of the show. Send us an email at media@techfreedom.org. Find this podcast in the iTunes store, where you can please leave us a review, because it will help others find the show. Thanks for listening.
A nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.